We're going to start with Jeff Chester. He's the director of the Center for Digital Democracy, and he'll lay the landscape of what is going on out there with regard to the threats to the Internet, as well as some other issues. So, Jeff, would you like to come up?
Thank you. This is fantastic to be at a place that's devoted to real community media, and I want to thank you for inviting me. But you probably don't know that I'm one of the handful, unfortunately, of public interest progressive organizations working in Washington around these media and digital media issues. And one of the reasons why we haven't been able to make as much progress over the last 20 and 30 years has been the fact that the progressive community generally hasn't really understood the role that public policy plays. There's a whole history here. In the 80s, I was active in helping create the campaign, which eventually established the Independent Television Service within public broadcasting. But since the early 90s, I've been in Washington really there to sort of fight this particular moment. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm 53, and I have been following media issues, I know, for quite a long time. We, my colleagues and I, and I like the Media Access Project, which is the country's oldest and, of course, only public interest telecommunications law firm in Washington, Consumers Union, Consumer Federation of America, that rounds it out on the media ownership, believe it or not, open access side when it comes to our side. Four groups, and the fact that my tiny organization is a group should make you anxious. And then, of course, we have a great group like the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, which has done remarkable work, but principally focused on the issues of privacy versus the issues of media democracy and the future of the Internet broadly. So let me just sort of succinctly say what's going on as far as I can, what I believe. The vision that the media giants have for the future of new media is old media. It's always been clear, and that's really the threat. And they never intended the Time Warners, you know, and the Universals and the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association, the lobbying infrastructure. They never intended, because I've been there now for 10, 11 years, and, you know, like you, I go to their conferences, I read their publications, you know, I follow them. I know them in many ways, which is why we and my colleagues have been able to expose them. But they immediately saw the Internet as a threat, and they had no intention of allowing the Internet to really develop as an alternative medium. This goes back to 10 years. The advertisers in particular. The advertisers did not want to see a medium develop that would truly offer people not only alternative approaches for information, but, God forbid, information for free, without the branding experience, like all the brandwashing of America, that's at the heart of the vision. And so what you have now going on is a campaign, fairly coordinated in a way, on the part of the media giants that has received the support of official Washington. And although the Clinton folks were horribly corrupt, and when it comes to the future of the openness of the Internet, were almost as bad, in Michael Powell, you sort of have potentially the James Watt, if you remember him, of media and telecom. So, look, here's what, and you can't look at all these things in an isolated way, and a lot of people do. I'm not saying you guys do, but a lot of people in the press. It's all interrelated. So what are they trying to do? All right, they're working, and they've been successful now to eliminate the limit on how many cable systems a single company can own. They took it to court. Time Warner, Jerry Levin's legacy is they took it to court. They basically said it violates our First Amendment rights as a corporation to have any limits whatsoever. Now, God forbid, you know, the limit we had to end up with was 30%. No company could control more than 30%. That's now been overturned. So what's likely to happen is the limit's going to go up to 50%, two companies will be able to control the entire cable television system. The television networks, of course, lobbied the 96 Act and got the digital spectrum for free, which is political leverage so they can get into cable systems. So I could talk about that if you wanted to. But the broadcast networks have challenged the limit on the number of stations any network can own. It had been 25, in the 96 Act. They wanted it 50. We fought them. We had to settle for 35. They went to court. They just got that overturned, in essence. So there won't be any limits on the number of television stations. You already know what's happened to radio. Every major newspaper company in this country, including the New York Times, right, and the Washington Post, are pursuing, along with their broadcast colleagues, to overturn a very critical safeguard that now prohibits the common ownership of a newspaper and a broadcast station in a single community. And I think the most important, the basic fundamental policy that has ensured the openness and non-discriminatory character of the Internet is now being reversed as it moves to broadband. And these are interrelated. The cable industry understands that it has the principal wire that will deliver to most citizens and consumers, the majority of consumers and citizens, the broadband connections, you know, for the immediate future. So they have removed all the ownership limits so a handful of people can control it. And now they are successful in ending the open access requirements. And let me explain. I'm sure you followed this. The dial-up internet was based on the phone system. It grew up. It evolved. You know, its DNA was based on the common carrier network philosophy. The telephone wires had to carry all traffic. You've heard Larry Lessig and others talk. You guys have all probably written about it. The intelligence was at the edges. The person that owned the wire didn't own content. And more importantly, the phone network cannot discriminate against content. They have to let your content through and your content through on fair terms. That is today's internet. That has been a very important, powerful tool for us all. That's not what the media industry wants. Because ultimately, the media industry, particularly cable, whom I see here as the most powerful negative forces, they've wanted all along to ensure that they could, I use the term, migrate their business model with television to the broadband environment. Their business model is, I control the wire, I control all the programming, and that's it. And you all know that you can't get on the cable unless you cut these guys in and all that stuff. All right? So what have they done? They have launched the campaign. They were very successful, unfortunately, under Clinton, who was, you know, horribly corrupt. The Bells have launched a similar campaign to end the open access policy. So here's what Michael Powell is doing. He announced he was coming up with a uniform policy for broadband. In February, released a proposal for the phone side called Wireline. In March, they released the proposal for cable modem service. In essence, they are declaring that it's not common carrier telecommunications, which is what we say it is. All right. They're saying it's an unregulated classification. It means that the company that controls the wire will be able to make all kinds of decisions about the terms of access for content. It means that ISPs will not have the full rights for interconnection. ISPs, we have more than 7,000 in this country, they will fade away. I was responsible with my colleagues for forcing the FTC to impose some open access requirements on AOL Time Warner as part of the merger. They have to do at least three, but you've had literally thousands. You're not going to have those anymore. And more importantly, they are going to, and they are, privatizing the architecture to ensure that their content, their applications, their branding vision is at the forefront of the experience that citizens and consumers have. Business models, you know, based on what I call paper packet, will emerge that will begin imposing hefty transport fees on streaming video content providers. Home screens will all be controlled. And then I want to sort of conclude by saying that I think it's very important that we fight to have as open a system as possible to ensure that alternative voices, community voices, and all kinds of other commercial voices, small, medium, even large, have access to the major platforms. And there's no question in my mind that they're migrating television integrating television, which they see as bringing the power of popular culture to promote advertising and marketing with the interactivity online. That's where you have a lot of the privacy issues. It's going to be a very powerful medium. They intend to control it. The four groups, with ACLU as amicus, have taken the FCC's decision to court. The Ninth Circuit will hear it. We hope that you will join us, and hopefully you will work with us to raise this issue. I'm sure you already have in town halls and across the country. There's very little support. There's absolutely very little support, and the corporations have been able to basically buy up the support of a lot of the traditional public interest community. I say, if you look at the AOL Foundation website and the Verizon Foundation website and see all the groups, including the civil rights groups, that get money, they've been neutralized and given funding to work on digital divide issues instead of who will control this network.
Could you explain about the suit and how people, maybe the IMC and various different organizations, could become?
I think there may still be time, actually, to file a suit. Certainly, there's time to file an amicus. And I think, as important as participating, we got to promote it. I mean, you know, we have, as a community, look, we've not taken any corporate money, right? The Media Access Project, Consumers Union, et cetera, my group, we don't take corporate money. We live off the handful of remaining liberal foundations. So there's very little resources because the foundations ultimately don't really want to fund a media and democracy movement. They don't want to make these giant corporations really accountable to the public. It's a real sort of uphill battle. So our resources are limited. So having people discuss, having publications, talking about online, writing articles, there's a whole bunch of things, and we're going to be working on, hopefully, in the next couple of months, because we just filed the suit, to put more information out there. But that would be very important. However, look, in every community, we have to argue that there has to be an alternative vision. We have to expose the architectural plans. We have to expose the political operations in every community. Even though the communities have very little power around the cable system, I assume you remember the 1984 Cable Act. And in the 1984 Cable Act, see, I come in around 1979 as a reporter, looking at cable and cable lobbying in California and seeing how they are making these promises and break them. Well, the cities and even the Alliance for Community Media are saying, well, cable broadband is a cable service, so they can get the franchise fee versus ensuring that it's a common carrier system. So, you know, people may not follow that, but, you know, the cities have basically benefited from the cable regulation and want broadband cable to be cable because they get 5% of gross revenue that goes into their general coffers. So, look, arguing that a town like Seattle and the adjoining communities articulating a broadband vision, exposing what they are trying to do, we can help you. We along with the ACLU, we're working on a pilot project in Portland to provide a blueprint so folks can look at the architecture. But I think we have to have just a lot of activism. I think we have to have a lot of anger, and I think we have to have a lot of information out there, and we have to put this issue up on the radar screen. Very few people know it's coming. It's harder and harder to get stories out, even in the print press, with all of this. You know, they see it as a boring story, but every time the LA Times has to write about this story, because I talk to their reporters every day, they know they've just been bought by the Tribune Company. When the New York Times has to write the story, well, last month they invested $100 million and became partner with the Discovery Channel. All right? Media consolidation has had a negative impact on the ability of journalists to really, I think, be brave and write critically about what's going on. Bill Moyers is an exception. He's going to do much more, and he started doing stuff. But it's really a very dire situation because you're going to have a handful of companies having even more political power. Their vision is just about selling. They're going to restructure the Internet in ways that will profoundly change its characteristics, and I'm afraid I think a lot of people are going to end up liking what they get, which is sort of, you know, Internet light. And it's going to weaken our goals for a more democratic and just society. So we hope we can work together.
Could you explain the whole Trump's Clear Channel.
The minute Clinton came in, I mean, some of us were so happy there was a Democrat, but the first words out of his mouth was deregulation, all right? So we were fighting him from day one. And in 96, when Republicans took over, then everything was going to go. All the things we're fighting now were really in the 96 Act. And I'd like to give us credit, my colleagues and I, because we were able to pull some of the bad stuff out that most people don't know, that we were able to pull stuff out, but we couldn't do anything to radio. We couldn't do anything. And they got rid of the limits. Now you can own, one company can own 8 stations in the community, and you have 2. What? Well, 2 companies now own basically, most of the channels, and there's no local programming and all that. I think it gives us a sense of what will happen. But I think that even radio and broadcasting, whatever happens, pales to what happens to broadband. Because on the broadband pipeline, all this information ultimately will travel. That will be the central system for most folks here. Right, that's what will be television. That's what will be broadcasting, and having broadband open, let alone having the commons within broadband, some part of that network that doesn't operate under the economic restraints that the big media companies intend to impose on the broadband delivery. Because remember, they have control over last mile. I mean, there's a lot of people who think we can bypass it, through wireless networks and all that. I don't think that's practical. I think we have to have open access on all the main platforms. I think the wireline platform is going to be a dominant platform to the majority of households. They're going to subsidize access through advertising. I don't think we can have a sort of a readout around it. There are people who think we can. And interactive television, they're investing billions of dollars in interactive television. PC penetration is expected to top off, or has topped off, at 50%, and they're thinking 50% of the folks are going to start using email and interactive TV. It's going to be a very important platform. We have to be there. It's my perspective. Progressive, public interest, community, alternative voices have to be on the major platforms.
Do you think it's realistic to even consider a legal strategy to accomplish anything? Because even if you win at some lower court, it's going to eventually go to the Supreme Court, and it's going to be reversed, and then very bad precedent.
Is there a legal strategy here? Certainly, much more of a legal strategy needs to be created. And, for example, there could be suits at the local level. Some of my colleagues believe that we might win the lower court, and even the Supreme Court, which last week, in a 7-1 decision, actually supported the right policy in requiring the local phone networks to interconnect. So look, I don't know. However, a legal strategy is important, but I also think a lot of effort in publicizing what is at stake, getting it out to community folks, getting it out to internet folks. If all these things go through, when I said it, one company in one town will be able to own several TVs, several radios, the newspaper, the cable system, and the principal ISP. Tremendous political power. And by the way, here in Seattle, you have actually the only publisher who is opposed to the elimination of the broadcast newspaper rule, Frank Blethyn, to his credit. But everybody else is supporting it, yeah.
So besides a litigation strategy and a public outreach strategy, what other opportunities can we consider that would allow us to get outside of what I would call their orbit?
Yeah.
And you mentioned wireless, and even though you don't think that's a real strong alternative, could you at least talk about what you think that has the potential to be, or at least what others think it might have the potential to be as a way to kind of go around their stranglehold? And are there any other technology strategies or other strategies that allow us to figure out how to get outside of their orbit?
Yeah, there are folks, there's a place called the New America Foundation, it's newamerica.yet, Yochai Benkler, B-E-N-K-L-E-R from NYU, is working with Larry Lessig on an open spectrum project on Wi-Fi and wireless, and clearly there's a lot of work being done. I guess my interest is not routing around. My interest is in fighting them to see if we can get access. I don't want to be, I think we'll be marginalized. So I think we have to do both. We have to fight I mean, one thing, for example, is none of the this issue has not resonated politically. I don't believe any of your congresspersons here, you know, certainly Cantwell, they are not taking the right position. I mean, Cantwell didn't even show up at the Comcast AT&T merger hearing. All right? So, you know, Washington, you folks could do also a big service by raising the visibility of this issue and what is at stake. And you should be fighting to deny the transfer, if it's not too late, of AT&T to Comcast. You should be creating a task force to look at the architecture that Comcast has in mind. You should be critiquing it, and you should have the resources with CPSR here to articulate a public interest vision for the greater Seattle area for a broadband, push your vision and show where they're pushing the blocks, where they're going to cash locally, and they're going to make sure that their content, their services get preferential treatment. I think we have to expose their plans are and create public consciousness and show what it's at stake. And this is one of the few issues that the progressives have where we can actually say we're also pro-business. Because the only people who are going to benefit from all these changes are the handful of big media companies and, you know, their affiliates. Even companies like Disney and Sony, believe it or not, are terrified, absolutely terrified about the power that these, the Comcast and Time Warner and the handful of cable companies will have. Now, they're silent, Disney. They have to be silent because if they criticize Comcast, they won't get access. So imagine if Disney's afraid. What about all the even medium-sized businesses in town? Once they find out what the new transport arrangements, Brian Roberts intends to start imposing all kinds of fees on the delivery of broadband services, right? Which I think is going to negatively impact the ability of folks to compete and will harm the civic infrastructure of a community when all of a sudden nonprofits and others find that they can't afford to communicate because you had this last mile problem. So I think you can try to rat around. I urge you to try to rat around. But I think we have to fight to get in. And I think they're vulnerable because they're greedy.
Isn't Earthlink and Verizon also a party to a suit?
Yeah, well, Earthlink has filed a suit. And Earthlink is an ally. And the only reason Earthlink is really around, in a way, is because the advocates forced the FTC to impose a minimum of three ISPs, unaffiliated ISPs. So Earthlink is fighting for its life. Verizon has filed a suit, and Verizon is running around campaigning against the AT&T Comcast merger, but it's a ruse. What Verizon and the Bells want is to end the open access policy. That's why they were behind a bill called Tozan Dingle, which just got a Senate version, just got introduced. They want to make trouble in the Comcast merger solely as a tactic to say, we want the same deregulatory treatment. All right? And they're funding folks to do stuff, and they're sending out, they've made an advocacy manual that the folks in Portland are passing out. Verizon, be careful about Verizon. Well, yes, but where I think cable is important is that I think that ultimately for a lot of people it will be an entertainment service, and cable is going to be able to bundle its significant investment in content, and DSL may end being more of a business service, while residential consumers, a lot of households, end up getting cable because you're going to get your cable TV. And let's remember, 85% of the country get their television through pay television now. 75% get it through cable, 10% get it through DBS. We have to be on that wire. Now, they are greedy because they control the last mile. They want to impose all these terms and conditions. They don't want open access. We have to expose them, make their life miserable, show there can be alternatives that are affordable and meaningful for competition and for democracy.
I just got Roadrunner in Woodstock, New York.
Oh, you do? Yes.
And just a couple of weeks ago.
They're watching everything you do, you know.
But they, we were having a lot of trouble with our ISP is Prodigy.
Yeah.
And we kept calling them and it kept, you know, giving us a lot of trouble. And they said, well, you have to change your ISP to AOL.
Yeah.
And it'll work much better.
Sure. Sure. Look, it's not that you won't be able to, well, I'll tell you, it's not that you won't be able to go to every website. It's that they will degrade the quality of service for all the competitors. Now, there's already been one threat, which I'll talk to you about, because it shows you where they're at. Charter Cable, Paul Allen, local. Well, it's great to be able to plug him locally here. Paul Allen, you know, Mr. Wired World. I mean, his wires, I said, is a prison camp, digital prison camp. He's a pretty smart guy. He now owns the number 5 cable company, right? In 2 years, he went from nothing. So Disney and Fox want to offer movies online, movies.com. What does Charter say to Disney? If you try to offer movies online, you know, in my area, Charter, fifth or sixth largest cable company, I am going to disengage. Any Charter customer who gets broadband internet from us will not be able to access your website. We're going to de-link you. They just threatened that a few weeks ago. And that was enough, basically, to get Fox. I mean, who cares about it? But it just shows you they will go to that extreme. So we have to be. So that's why we need to articulate a community civic architecture. That's what we need to do. Our architecture, take the big guys can be out there, but everybody else has an equal opportunity to be out there. It's non-discriminatory. It's abundant. It serves all needs. We don't have to live with the architecture that the cable guys want to give us, which ultimately bandwidth starves the kind of community applications, let alone the alternative commercial applications that we want to see. A community architecture that's democratic and diverse. That's what we're missing here, and that's what I'm hoping that folks are thinking about, and the folks at DIAC. Look, and I want to end, I appreciate your time with this. We can't win in Washington. They're all working for the industry. It's a revolving door, okay? Our side has no money, let alone, right? And we're not going to get any money anytime soon, right? More and more of the foundations just don't want to do it. Digital rights management, by the way, the fact that they're trying to privatize the entire system and blah, 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 it's also a part of this whole thing. They're all interrelated. But we need community folks. We need to have a campaign back outside of Washington. So all of a sudden, members of Congress and city council people start hearing, this is an issue. What's happening to my internet? What's happening to open access? What's happening? You know, what will broadband look like? What are the terms and conditions? Why are we letting this company make the decisions, the private architectural decisions for this network? Here are 20 experts, and my God, you have them, half the population here is probably an expert. Here's what we can do. Challenge them. Fight them.
Several of us here tonight are currently organizing a week-long media democracy event in Seattle in September.
Great.
Well, the National Association of Broadcasters.
The radio conference, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
And we're hoping to be a stepping stone to this larger national campaign.
Actually, there's only 3 people coming, and they all work for Clear Channel.
With a blackout on these issues, basically, in the media, and it being a non-issue for politicians, as you're saying, what are you seeing as some of the better opportunities for raising these issues at a broad public level?
I mean, I think issue a mini report that really looked at what's happened with radio and the fact that there are no local DJs anymore, et cetera, and there's no local news, and God forbid there was ever an earthquake, there's nobody in that place to tell people to get, you know. I mean, I think you can criticize them and focus and show what's at stake and that it's emblematic. It's a litmus test of what we're about to get. But I'm happy to talk with you about I think you should make a lot of trouble here. At the radio conference, even though I personally believe broadband is where the fight should be. Because with all due respect, here's what I think. We lost radio, we lost broadcasting, we lost cable. All right? We lost. Where's it going? Okay, they haven't figured it out how to control it all yet. They're working on it. They haven't figured out the business models yet. It's a different system, and we have something that we've never had before in the mass media organizing movement. We have a medium that really evolved as a truly sort of democratic open medium. Now that medium is being purposely integrated into the commercial mass media, but we can say, wait a second, the Supreme Court said in the CDA case, this was the most participatory democratic medium ever created. What are you guys doing with it? Don't you see the inconsistency?
No, I was...
have a question here. I was just going to respond to what Susan said. I think there's a great segue between all of the I work with youth, I teach, and between all of the youth who turned to the internet because the radio was being sold out and the broadband campaign. And I urge you to do something about that as a 10-year-old. Admittedly do something around that, but try and figure out a way to create a demand that moves into saying, look, we lost on radio, it's trash, it's junk, we all went to the internet to find some good stuff, now you're trying to take that away from us as well. There's a constituency there. Look at all the millions of people that go to the internet because they've given up on radio. I think that's a generational segue that has to be.
I agree with you about the youth, and with the broadcasters, I think it's a good point. Just one thought, you could immediately talk about the digital giveaway. So, go away from radio. They lobbied Congress in 96 deliberately to get this digital spectrum, so they would be given this preferential placement within a broadband. Nobody else will, right? I mean, so there's a way of criticizing what the broadcasters are doing on the TV side that might be useful. Yeah.
Leverage or power would a progressive city council have to try to jam this up in some way? Mike has some thoughts too, but we've got a city council that I in Seattle that I think would be open to listening to a lot of this, and several of them who would actually, I think, go on the offensive. And so beyond just posturing, what are some meaningful things that we could ask them to do?
And your city council did pass this, I believe the city council, the privacy stuff, which was terrific. First place, I think there needs to be a moral voice. I think that they have the court of sort of public pressure. That's going to force Comcast to sort of reposition. The cable industry has been able to erode the power that cities have had over the years to regulate local services, but as far as I know, cities still are allowed to set the terms for to ensure meaningful consumer protection. So under the consumer protection policy framework that local franchising authorities have, they could examine the architecture to look at the upload and download capacity, et cetera. See, they're not allowed to define the architecture, but there's a backdoor way of doing it. And your cable franchise people know it. The problem is that they need the political support, I think, to do something. So there is a leverage here, and particularly if you can expose the architectural plants, I think that's something that could generate a lot of press. When you find out that they're not building a robust network for you, that there's going to be limits. Cable is purposely engaged in a process of quote unquote bandwidth starving. That's what somebody who's an economic analyst told me. Bandwidth starving their broadband environment because they don't want to allow a lot of competition. So they've deployed this broadband, but what are they doing first? This thing called video on demand, which is a lot of movies. They're purposely limiting the amount and the capacity in order to ensure that they get all the revenues and that competitive broadband content landscape doesn't emerge. I think they can be challenged on that. But we would certainly, my colleagues, we would work with you on that. Last one, thanks.
What do you make of the prospects for condominium fiber as something that a city or a local authority can develop?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to your question. That's really what should be happening here. There should be this kind of municipal plan, laying out of abundant fiber. They should be requiring, maybe they do it here, that whenever the cable company, many cities do this, I don't know if Seattle's doing it, whenever the cable company digs, some cities basically say, we have to lay our dark, what they call dark fiber in. All right? Yes, to the extent that there is a plan to create a meaningful alternative infrastructure, and there's full interconnection, which there should be, that's the way to do it.
That was Jeff Chester, director of the Center for Digital Democracy based in Washington, D.C. He spoke in Seattle a few weeks ago. For more information or to get involved, visit their website at www.democraticmedia.org. We'll conclude the program with a talk by broadcast journalist Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's daily series Democracy Now! which we're lucky enough to be able to hear here in the Finger Lakes weekdays at 9 a.m. Amy spoke as part of a teach-in held in conjunction with the protests against the World Economic Forum meeting in New York City in January. As you listen, consider what American public opinion might be if the stations that play Rush Limbaugh played Democracy Now!, if political discussions among the citizenry were of the facts and ideas presented by, for example, Amy Goodman and Jeremy Scahill. It's not a question of bias. Limbaugh's program is no less an expression of his point of view and arguably is less fact-based. It's a question, ultimately, about what ideas and analyses are allowed to reach us, or rather are pushed at us, while others are suppressed or marginalized by scarce outlets.
The great privilege today to speak to you. How does the New York Daily News describe people like you? Legions of agitators, crazies, parasites, and kooks. But it gets a little more serious. The Daily News compared critics of the World Economic Forum to the terrorists who attack the World Trade Center, saying New York will not be terrorized. And the New York Times columnist Clyde Haberman described globalization activists as people, quote, less known for their deep thinking than for their willingness to trash cities, saying some would say that New York needs this protest about as much as it needs another airplane attack. This is a quote chosen by FAIR, a very important organization, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, as it depicts New York City newspapers smearing activists ahead of the World Economic Forum protests. This is extremely serious because it provides the justification, the foundation for serious police brutality, because anything seems to be justified in the face of terroristic attacks, in the face of attacks that might kill people. But who is it that is responsible for deaths around the world? As a new report that was just released today points out, a new report from the world, from the Public Citizen, called Davos World Economic Forum, Pricey Corporate Trade Association Loses Its Camouflage. They talk about who is here and the advantages that they gain, those who attend the World Economic Forum. A quote from CNN Financial News: the World Economic Forum provides an unmatched opportunity for the world's most powerful people to bump into each other in the Congress's narrow hallways and then adjourn quietly to a back room to talk business. So you have many world political leaders who are here hobnobbing with the global corporate elite to determine the global economic agenda, which goes beyond finances, which goes to shoring up corporations, many of which have larger budgets than the world's nations. If you look at the 100 largest budgets in the world, more than half of them are not countries. They are global corporations. And what are these corporations involved with? A few years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, where in the last few days, thousands have died as a result of a munitions dump blowing up. But it is very important to look at militarism in Nigeria and around the world and who has supported the regimes that have built up the forces that are so dangerous to their own people. A few years ago, I went there with Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill, and we were looking at just one oil corporation and its behavior in a place that the world's media, some of the most powerful corporations in the world, doesn't bother to look. We were looking at Chevron, which has the largest corporation based in California. Chevron, which in the spring of 1998 flew in Nigeria's notorious Navy and mobile police known as the Kill and Go. to a community in the Niger Delta, just another community that was protesting an oil giant's despoilation, destruction of the environment, asking for some kind of reparations and cleanup. They went to a Chevron barge asking to meet with the Chevron representative, the top one, the American, who was, they knew, would be responsible, who, if he had to respond, that they could be sure something would be done. They saw the Chevron helicopters flying in, thinking that they were bringing in the negotiators, but instead they flew in the mobile police, the kill and go, and they landed on the barge. They opened fire on the protesters, killing two, wounding another, rounding up those that were left, putting them in Nigeria's notorious jails where some of them were tortured. This is corporate behavior. This, like those killed at the World Trade Center, those innocent people who lost their lives, is very straightforward. It's terrorism. It's terrorism in Chile in 1973 when AT&T, working with President Richard Nixon and the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, it's terrorism when they, working together, overthrew a democratically elected regime, and in the ensuing years, thousands of innocent Chileans were killed. It's terrorism in Guatemala when for more than 40 years, the successive Guatemalan militaries, backed to the hilt by the U.S. government, killed more than 150,000 innocent Guatemalan citizens. Yes, it's terrorism in Vietnam when 2 million Vietnamese were killed, Henry Kissinger being one of those responsible for that murderous war. These are the killing of innocent civilians like those killed at the World Trade Center. And those responsible for these massive deaths must be brought to justice, must be tried in international fora like the International Criminal Court, which has been fought covertly and overtly by the U.S. Pentagon and by the U.S. government. Why? They expressly say they're concerned that U.S. officials will be brought before those courts and tried. They don't want U.S. soldiers or officials brought and judged by an international court. Yes, someone like Osama bin Laden and his allies should be brought before that court, but we have to have a universal standard of justice, and people like Henry Kissinger must be tried as well. Now, these are the kinds of issues that should be raised on a regular basis if we had a fair media, an objective media that weighed lives equally. And that is why it is so important to support the independent media. The last time I was here in this building was just after the U.S. began bombing Afghanistan. At that time, me and many of my colleagues had been taken off the air at WBAI. But it is because of people like you around the country, pro-media democracy activists, tens of thousands of people who fought for the last few years, who fought a corporate takeover of the only independent media network in this country, and that is Pacifica Radio, and we have regained our network, and the banned and the fired have been returned to the airwaves. We do experience great victories when people are persistent, and I think that that victory, though we have a long way to go in democratizing our network, but that victory will inspire many different movements in a time of great repression when people feel like they're losing so much ground. It is absolutely critical that we celebrate the moments when we can take back the public space. Pacifica Radio, founded more than 50 years ago by a man named Lou Hill in Berkeley, California, who had refused to fight in World War II and came out of the detention camps along with 40,000 others who refused to fight then, and said there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that beat the drums for war because they profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was founded, with the first station, KPFA. It's why people like Paul Robeson, when banned from the airwaves all over this country and only welcome in a few black churches, knew that he could go to KPFA, the first Pacifica station, and be heard and be broadcast. He knew that there was a safe space there. And it is that safe space that grew to five stations around the country, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington, and KPFT in Houston. KPFT going on the air in 1970, the transmitter blown up twice by the Ku Klux Klan in the first year of operation. And when the exalted Cyclops went on trial, he said it was his proudest act because he understood how dangerous Pacifica was, because it opened the airwaves, not, I think, to the minority, but to the majority of voices that are excluded from the mainstream media that continues to beat the drums for war. I think it's no accident that one of the first protests in New York after the bombing of Afghanistan, people marched from Union Square, which had almost become a peace and democracy park until Giuliani had it cleaned up, but where people marched from Union Square to Times Square, yes, named for the New York Times, which is there now, but also the site of the Armed Forces recruiting station. Sometimes it's hard to tell the two apart. The way the media recruits for war. It is absolutely critical we support independent media and that we challenge the mainstream media, especially the corporate networks that are using our airwaves. They are the public airwaves. They are just leasing them. They're supposed to be used for the public good, not to sell military hardware like we saw in the Persian Gulf War, Westinghouse owning CBS and General Electric owning NBC, makers of most of the parts in the of military weapons in the Persian Gulf War. It's no accident that we watched a military hardware show then, as we did in the bombing of Yugoslavia, as we did and continue to do in the bombing of Afghanistan. The Pentagon understands well what bothers people, and I believe what bothers the majority of people. And that is looking at civilian casualties. And that is why it bought up the Iconos satellite imagery, the satellite imagery of the destruction on the ground that could hone in on license plates and certainly show us what civilian casualties look like. They wanted to ensure, if they got the exclusive rights, that while the war was being waged, or I should say the bombing campaign was going on, that we would not be subjected to those images that would turn a population against a military that was committing those crimes against humanity. Yes, what happened on September 11th was certainly terrorism, 3,000 people in New York alone being killed. But more than that have now been killed in Afghanistan. What happened on September 11th, the killing of people like Abe Zalmanowicz, for example, on the 27th floor, whose sister Rita Lazar condemned the loss, the deep tragic loss of her brother, who stayed behind to be with his friend Ed, who is a paraplegic, and said he'd stay with him even though he easily could have gotten out until he got help, and he went down with so many others. But Rita said, and wrote a piece to the New York Times, a letter, "Not in my name, not in my brother's name." As Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez said in a letter that didn't get published but circulated around the internet, their son Greg Ernesto Rodriguez, who worked at Cantor Fitzgerald, they said, "Not in our son's name. Don't cause innocent Afghan fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers to grieve like we are. That will not in any way alleviate our pain." And Rita Lazar felt so strongly about this that she went to Afghanistan to bridge the sorrow with those who, like her, were the victims of a terrorist attack. She went with the human rights group Global Exchange, with others who also lost their loved ones, like Kelly Campbell. Her brother-in-law, Craig Amundsen, died in the attack on the Pentagon on September 11th. And she went with Rita and Medea Benjamin, and they traveled around Kabul, and they met a little boy who was 6 years old but seemed like an infant. Why? He was a healthy kid until the U.S. bombing campaign began and the house next door to his was bombed. He didn't seem like he'd suffered physically, but he regressed and was just a drooling baby who could no longer speak and had to be carried around. Or the 10 and 11-year-old brother and sister who no longer speak because their neighbor's house was bombed, and they go into spasm. She met those little kids, and she thought about her brother-in-law's little children here in the United States and their loss, and thought, how is it that we think in this country that it is acceptable to avenge the deaths of innocent people by killing innocent people? The polls all show, at least what's expressed on television, that more than 90% of Americans want to bomb Afghanistan. I don't believe that for a minute. I think it is critical we ask, what is the question that was asked? If people were asked, do you think the loss of innocent life should be avenged by the killing of more people? I don't think 90% of people would say yes. In fact, it would probably be completely reversed. 90% of people would say no. And so the way that the corporate media allows this to take place and beats the drums for war is to simply keep information from us, not let us see the civilian casualties, or as Walter Isaacson, head of CNN, instructed the journalists to say, the faces on TV that you see, to say if by chance they saw civilian casualties, images were portrayed on CNN, to say, don't forget the terrorists who killed the World Trade Center, who killed people at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. Now, how is this connected to what's happening this weekend? How is this connected to the images we're seeing on television? Well, the media has done it for us. They show us the police actions preparing for this weekend to make people afraid to go out and express their dissent. I was talking to a Columbia grad student who was saying particularly foreign students are afraid to go out as we see repressive laws, increasingly the INS working with the police, afraid that they could be picked up and face more than a couple of days in jail. But we see how the police are preparing, and when you equate dissenters with terrorists, anything can happen to you. And so sane people are afraid to go out in the streets, or parents say to their children, please don't do that, don't make us afraid. And so it's the very brave people who go out and say, we understand that the kind of policies that are being discussed and pushed forward and promulgated at organizations like the World Economic Forum, of 3,000 of the world's top corporate leaders hobnobbing with politicians and global leaders, that this is dangerous. When you don't have citizen activists around the world representing civil society right in there saying there is another kind of development and globalization that will stop the vicious cycle of hatred and recrimination that leads to more attacks that we saw on our soil. It is absolutely critical that people be seen on the streets and that the media come into places like this. Yes, I see cameras, but I don't see the networks here, as I didn't see in Seattle in the first days before people went out on the streets, when an unprecedented thousands of people packed the Symphony Hall to hear people speak and discuss ideas about grassroots globalization. No, the media wasn't there showing that give and take, that dialogue, but instead they focused on the shattered glass. Instead they focused on people responding to the attacks by police. That's what was violent on that day. And that, I believe, is the response we're going to see increasingly around the world, like we saw in Genoa with the killing of an activist. When you have the kind of global uprising against corporate power that we have seen in the last few years, it will be met by increasing repression, but it only shows how successful and threatening peaceful nonviolence is. It is absolutely critical that people stand up now more than ever. People challenge the media to tell the truth and stop reflecting the views of a minority elite, and we're not talking about people of color. That people stand up against the consensus that's hailed in Congress between the Democrats and the Republicans, who all are benefiting from corporations like Enron. It's tough to find a congressman or senator that didn't have his palms greased or his pockets lined by that corrupt corporation. We have to break the cycle of violence and decide what we want to be. Do we want to be from the country on earth, the number one superpower whose power is determined by the weapons it sells to repressive regimes? Do we want to be the sword, or do we want to represent to people around the world and to people here at home the shield? We have to make the decision, each one of us, the sword or the shield. Thank you.
That was Amy Goodman speaking in January in New York City as part of the protests surrounding the meeting of the World Economic Forum.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.